All right.
No recorder.
Where's the recorder?
No, I can't find it, actually. It's not in the back. It's not back there.
Uh-oh.
I have no idea, so I guess I'll just stick with my phone.
No bueno.
No bueno at all.
Cool. Hey, two things for you guys this morning. One, we start at 6, just as a reminder, which means 6 o'clock, butts in seats, caffeinated, ready to go, not walking in at 6:01, getting coffee, okay? It's a reminder for all of us, so here at 6, okay? It's just October. The weariness hasn't even begun, okay? So please be disciplined about that, okay? And a note on our passive-aggressive board here, okay? It's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but just to give you guys a rundown, this actually got moved up the food chain to me now. It costs about $50 a week to buy milk and to make cold brew and those sorts of things around here, okay? So you guys are, we are consuming that, and it wasn't a big deal until all of a sudden they kept realizing there were dishes left out after residency and weren't sure who was doing it, okay? They were washed, but they weren't put away. And then when staff members have to go back in and clean up our mess continually, coffee carafes, the dishes that we drink, the cereal that we eat, it's now become an issue, okay? So it wasn't a big deal until we aren't taking responsibility for our stuff and cleaning up, okay? I'm not going to be the guy that puts the kibosh down yet, okay? So if you want to enjoy some cold brew, please do recognize that it is very expensive, okay? And it's not a free-for-all. We make coffee every morning for us to drink, so bring your own, drink that, but just be aware of that, okay? But milk specifically, I think, is almost $50 a week that we spend in milk, okay? So when we're pounding milk and cereal, and we're not bringing in any to replace it, it says something, okay? So just, I want you guys to be mindful of it. So if you want to contribute to the milk fund or BYOM, that would say a lot to the connections team that's spending their budget, okay? We do have a budget here at the well, and when it starts getting excessive in those departments, they start looking to figure out where's the hole, and the hole appears to be in residency, okay? So please enjoy it, but be mindful, okay? This isn't a handout, and we just don't have unlimited funds to do that, okay? Alex, do you have a thought?
Almost like more than like the cost of the milk, is like one of our 516 leaders is the one that like replenishes the milk, and she's also like one of our admins, and so it takes like a lot of time like out of her week to go pick up more milk, and then everyone on staff like blames her when there's no milk left, and so just to like protect her, like it would be good just to be mindful of it because she's paying for it and we're drinking it, so
yeah. So just be mindful of this. And by the way, this isn't us. I don't know who wrote from our staff, residency stopped drinking our milk, but I'm not cool with that. So we don't handle things in passive-aggressive ways around here. So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, so but that's not cool. So I appreciate the people that came to me and personally had a conversation with me and said, Mike, can you talk to the residents? Love them, want them to enjoy milk and cereal, that's fine. And they specifically said, look, I don't want to put the kibosh down, I don't want to be like the no-fun person, but we're blowing our budget, so we need to do something, okay? So you guys are adults, you'll handle yourselves responsibly. I don't want to be the legalist and insert law. That's the next step. If I have another conversation with, or someone has another conversation with me, that's what I'm going to have to do. I don't want to do that. You guys don't want to do that. So enjoy it. Enjoy your freedoms. But recognize other people are giving their hard-earned money to this church so that we can have milk at 16. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay, cool. All right, Proverbs 22. Let's go there.
First.
Pardon?
First.
1. 22:1.
A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold.
A good name, a good reputation. When someone speaks of your name, what do they hear? What do they think? Solomon would say that is more desirable to have a great name than great wealth. Why would that be? If you crater your name, your reputation, how much money does it take to undo that?
Nothing.
Nothing, right? Your name's your name. Man, if you become someone who's completely just bombed your name because of poor decisions or what have you, you're not going to get that back. I look, because I live right off the 168, every time I drive by the Volkswagen dealership, I look at that lot and think, oh, you guys have absolutely cratered your name. Have you guys seen that dealership recently? Heard the story of Volkswagen? They basically systematically lied on emissions testing to get their diesel cars to pass emissions and to get better fuel efficiency ratings than they were actually doing. And they rigged the system to do that to the tune of like, it's like billions of dollars worth of things that they've done, and they were ultimately found out. And it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened several times with them. And if you go walk their car lot now, there are no cars out there. Like, the worst job in the world right now is a Volkswagen car salesman. What a horrible job to have. Because you're trying to sell a product that everybody knows is a farce, right? And you go look at their lot, and it's like 5% full. They're trying to like creatively make it look like it's full with like 8 spots in between each car type deal. It's awful. And every time I look back, I just think, oh, you poor guys, you're suffering the decision of some dude or some gal up the food chain that decided that they were going to cheat on emissions testing, and you, Fresno local salesmen, are suffering the consequences of that because your name is attached to that business. It's so unfortunate, right? So I think about that all the time when I drive by there. There's also the other side of things, like great examples of that. I think of my brothers in the music world, Jimmy and Lee, you have to help me out. Really, really nice violins. Is it Stradivarius that I'm thinking of? The handcrafted violins? That's a family name, right? And their reputation. A Steinway piano. They're stupid expensive, but they built a reputation on their name. You think about the genius of marketing. That's all it is people trying to get you to believe in their name, their product. And when you have built a reputation, people will pay millions of dollars to attach their brand to an individual, to a company, whatever it may be, when a name has been built and a name signifies something. You think about Ducati in motorcycles, Ferrari, Lamborghini. Those are all just family names, right? That some dude decided to build a car, and today they are the most exquisite, expensive vehicles in the world, right? And that's built on someone's reputation. It's to care about the craftsmanship and the quality that they put into their line of work. How much more so as believers should our name say those things? That should communicate integrity, communicate value, a walk with God. Not perfection, right? But someone that says, man, they care. And when I ask them to do a job, it's going to get done. Or I know I can trust that person. Single ladies, are there names that go around in guys' circles that ladies will say, don't touch that guy with a 10-foot pole. He's trouble. He has no integrity. Do not date him. Do not go to coffee with him. It happens because people have tarnished their names with previous relationships. So we could go on and on and on talking about names and examples of people that we've heard of and have done that, okay? And unfortunately, it's out there. As you think about your name, Solomon would say, man, that's one of the greatest attributes you have. It's more important than the acquisition of silver or gold or any type of monetary wealth. The wealth that you have in your name is going to be everything. As we continue to journey through Genesis, you're going to meet a guy by the name of Joseph, whose name is literally gold. He has the Midas touch, and everyone around him loves him, values him, trusts him. He gets put in positions of leadership that are absolutely ridiculous, because of his name, because of his character and his integrity. And we'll get to him, obviously, in our journey down the road. Okay, so just to know for all of us, our name, our reputation is important. And our lineage that comes from us is going to suffer either in the consequences of our decisions, and they're going to live downstream of our name, or they are going to be uplifted and have a step forward in life because of the name that we give them and the reputation that they have of being a part of our lineage. All right, so thoughts on that before we move on.
I was going to say it's really like actually true, because every time it seems like I talk to a person who's not a believer that I just have random conversation with, and then they just ask me, like, you know, are you a Christian or something? And I tell them, yeah, I am. It seems like, oh, dang, here we go. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and they have like kind of the wrong perspective of Christians.
Yeah.
And it happens to me a lot, especially like when I went to Fresno City. Like I got told that so many times, or even just personal myself, like from past decisions. And friends that hung out with me in the past that now hangs out with new friends, and I talk to that new friend, it's kind of like, yeah, no.
You look at that, and you look at, like, the antithesis of that, like, Mother Teresa. And you think about that name. Anybody would listen to her because she's built a reputation of caring for the poor, right, and involving herself in life and sacrificing. So you may not believe in her message, but you'll stop and listen to her because of the name, the reputation she has. Yeah, in the same way, Christians have done a lot to tarnish that. And there's certain Christians out there that, absolutely, we've deserved a lot of that in some way. So,
thank God in Christ Jesus, we need a new name.
Golly, right?
No matter how jacked up we were.
Adopted into a new family, absolutely, right? So I don't mean to say perfection in any of this, so hear that. But our reputation matters, our work matters, our integrity matters, all those things matter. We're going to pass on hopefully a name as believers as well in our society. So, all right, with that, we're going to look at some jacked-up names in the outpourings of Genesis. Let's pray, and let's turn back to Genesis 25. We finished 24 last week with Abraham and Eleazar. So let's jump in here and keep rolling in our time. God, thank you for... as Troy rightly said, our names, God, that we are sons and daughters of the Most High King, that we have a new name adopted, Father, by you, that we are in right relationship with you because of the work that you have done on our behalf. Father, thank you for drawing us to you in our sin, in our own depravity, and Father, even lack of awareness of where we were and our need for you. Father, you were so gracious. So God, for this morning as we are grateful men and women to be here to study your word. Father, would you teach us? Would you, God, help us to see the errors of the ways of some of the men and women of the past? Would you help us to celebrate their successes and everything in between? And we, Father, as we study them, would we become more like our Savior? Would we model our lives to be more like Jesus as best we can? And as we seek to do that, as we fail in the process, Lord, would you give us grace? Would you help us to walk well with you, to get up when we fail, and to go about it again, Father? Thank you for our Savior, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right. So we are through with 24. We're picking up in 25 now. This is a bit of a tweener chapter, if you will, in between. Now passing the baton from Abraham, who's been our number one, our first patriarch, as we're rolling through kind of the big picture pieces of Genesis. We're going to see now that baton get handed to Isaac. Isaac gets a very small portion of the story. It's quickly moving now to Jacob and Esau. But his story is fascinating, and you're going to see, as we talked about him, and it's kind of I labeled him on the chart, this is a typical like father, like son. The sins of the father, his struggles that Abraham had, we're going to see handed now to Isaac, and it's frightening to see some of the aftermath of kind of how a father lives his life and the things that it instills in his son, either good or bad, okay? So 25:1 all the way through verse 11, we're going to see now the death of Abraham. 12 and following, after that, we're going to see the descendants of Ishmael. God promised that this guy would be blessed, and indeed he does get blessed. Different than Isaac, but blessed nonetheless. And then 19 and following now, we're going to see the family line from Abraham now continue through the one son, the only son, as God calls him, Isaac, and that line get blessed. And the promise of God... what happens now that Abraham's dead or is about to die? What happens with this promise of land and seed and blessing? Will it continue? Will it outlive Abraham? Will it continue with his son, or is it dead? Okay, so 25:1. We talked about this a little bit last week. Now Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah, and we saw the sons that he had with her. So has several more sons and daughters with this lady. But verse 5, even with all these kids that he has, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. So this is the son with the double portion of the blessing. He's the one that gets everything. Now, everything meaning the double portion. Verse 6, he still takes care of his other kids. Someone read that.
But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east.
Again, we saw that lesson that Abraham learned early on, right, with booting Isaac out of the camp, and God says, oh no, you're bringing him back, booted Ishmael out. He and Hagar both came back. Abraham had to raise them for 13 years, make sure he was taking care of them. So he's not abandoning his fatherly duties. He certainly cares for his other sons. Isaac gets the double portion of the blessing, okay? Katie, here's the sad part, verse 7.
These are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people.
Isn't that a great way to die? Died at a ripe old age, an old man, satisfied with life. Wouldn't you guys love to look back on your life and say, I wouldn't do anything differently. No regrets. Obviously, Abraham's made some mistakes in his life, so we're not talking about perfection here, but to go, you know what? Lord, I did it right, and I finished well. And one day to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, boy, that is a high call, right, and a high bar for all of us. But Abraham lives life well and dies, and now is going to die at a ripe old age to be buried by his sons. Verse 9, this is fascinating. Read that.
Then his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, facing Mamre.
All right, you guys remember the field that Abraham purchased? He got ripped off, double price, Machpelah. Who buries him, by the way?
Both sons.
Both of his sons. Isn't that cool? So whatever tension was there between Ishmael and Isaac, we're assuming there probably was some. It seems like they buried the hatchet, right? They now have come back to bury dad. Funerals have a funny way of reuniting family some ways, in a good way or a bad. But they come back, right? And they bury their dad in the cave of Machpelah, verse 10, with Sarah, his wife. Okay, so the first two, the patriarch and the matriarch of the family of God, are now buried together in that cave in Canaan, in the promised land. Not back in Ur, not back in Padam Aram, but they get buried in their new home, get laying claim to the land. Okay, came about verse 11 after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived in Beer Lahoy Roy, which is somewhere around Beersheba in the south, in the Negev, in that area. It's a well that's mentioned back in chapter 16, I think verse 4 it is, part of Abraham's journey, so he's living there, okay? Now, 12 and following, here are the descendants of Ishmael. We won't go through all of these, but Ishmael has 12 sons, okay? So he gets blessed as well, has a big family, lives east of his families, east of the family of God. You see at the end of verse 18, he settled in defiance of or east of all his relatives. He settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt as one goes towards Assyria. So again, south of the promised land, south of the Negev is where the Ishmaelites lived, in kind of that region. Okay, we see in verse 17 that he was 137 years old when he dies, breathes his last, and was gathered to his people. Okay, doesn't, by the way, get buried in the cave of Machpelah. Okay, that is not his line, that is not his blessing. So he is he's buried somewhere out there. We don't know for sure where, I don't know at least, but that's where their family lands were. Yeah, Joseph.
So it seems interesting that Ishmael's life is summarized in five chapters, or five verses. But do we know more about, like, this tribe that he formed?
We'll see pieces of them throughout the Genesis story. We'll see more of them, but they're the sideshow. They're not the main show. The main show is Abraham, now to Isaac, to Jacob, so they're not going to get the major press. But we're certainly going to see more of them, and they are blessed and numerous, as God says they will. This is it will be. So, okay. Now, 19, we move back now to the family of God. Okay, these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. And when Abraham became the father of Isaac, Isaac was 40 years old, verse 20, when he took Rebekah. Verse 21, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. Sound familiar? So again, if you're God, this seems nuts, but I guess if you're God, it's not, right? Let's pick another woman who's also barren that's going to start the whole family of God, and yet she's going to be barren as well. And this is how God continues to do this. Now, 22, or end of 21, the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So this barren woman now has a child, actually two. Read that. Someone pick up in 22.
But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, then why am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord.
Okay, so she's feeling literally within her, these two kids wrestling, if you will. And in 23, God makes a fascinating commentary on these two kids that are in her stomach. Or womb, I should say. 23, Tiana, keep rolling.
The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall grow stronger than the other, and the other shall serve the younger.
And the older, yes, shall serve the younger. So this is fascinating. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. What does that mean? Two nations are in your womb.
That means they're going to start a lineage?
Yeah. So the two kids that are about to come out of you are going to be, a nation is going to come from each one of those boys. Okay?
Why is it the older serving the younger?
Great question. Okay? What's the theme of Genesis?
Sovereign election.
Okay? Now, we saw with the first patriarch and matriarch, Abraham and Sarah, they had two kids, Ishmael and Isaac. Okay? Which one was picked?
Isaac,
the younger. Okay, now, why could you make the argument why God had to choose Isaac and not Ishmael? What would the logical argument be?
Because she was off the servant's kid.
Yeah, so Ishmael came from Hagar, not from Sarah. So the only true son from Sarah and Abraham, from their womb, from their bodies, was Isaac. So God was forced to choose that. Okay, you could make that argument. Now, what's the better argument in true sovereign election? Let's take two kids that are in the womb who've done absolutely nothing good nor bad. And God says from the get-go, the older shall serve the younger. On what basis is God making this decision? Is it actions? Is it deeds? Is it missteps? Is it...
Romans 9:12, not by works, but by him who calls.
I choose. I do whatever I want to because I am God. This is a beautiful picture of the sovereign electing purposes of God. Okay, it is absolutely the illustrating point of Romans. And Paul uses this argument in the dialogue of Romans to explain sovereign election. These kids have done nothing. They're not good. They're not bad. There's not one that's favored over the other. They simply are. They're not even born yet, right? They can't do anything. And yet God says the older is going to be a servant to the younger. Malachi chapter 1. Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. Again, we talked about this in here. It's the idea of chosen and not chosen. Is Esau going to be blessed? Absolutely. Is Jacob rather going to be the one that gets the blessing? Yes.
Is that God why said so. Moses gets chosen instead of Aaron? Because Aaron was the older brother?
They both get chosen. Aaron's going to be the beginning of the Levites. He's going to start that tribe. But they're both, yeah, in a sense, God picks who he wants. So, certainly. Okay? So from the get-go, the Lord says to, verse 23, her, to Rebekah, however, the idea would be, obviously, Isaac is aware of this. This would have been known to him clearly. When God makes this kind of proclamation pre-birth, they would have been aware that this was God's desire. Okay? 24, someone pick up there.
When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau.
How about that? So this guy comes out of the womb like with Kyle's beard, right? He's a hairy guy. He's a redhead, okay? Esau literally means red. Esau is going to be the father, by the way, of what nation? Edom. The Edomites come from Esau, okay? So it means red, okay? So he's the first one out of the womb. He is the older. They named him Esau because they said, wow, he's red, we'll call him red, which is what Esau means, okay? Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding onto Esau's heel. His name was called Jacob. What does Jacob mean, by the way? Anybody got a note?
Deceiver.
Deceiver, heel catcher, surplanter. It literally means like to grasp by the heel. So they named him Jacob. It means trickster. It's not a real positive name, by the way. So there's several names in scripture that people name their kids, at times you're like, no, I don't think you know what that means. So Jacob is going to be a guy that's going to get significantly refined by God and worked over. But man, in his beginnings, he is a deceiver, a trickster, a scam artist, if you will. He's going to do everything in his power to get his way. He is not content with the way things are, and he will do kind of Malcolm X by any means necessary to get his way. That's kind of Jacob theology early on in his life. And you're going to see that change, but that's kind of his take, okay? Yep. So two kids.
I like how mad he got when he went to purchase Rebecca for the well, we obviously
yeah,
we'll get to it, but I like how he's just pissed beyond pissed.
Yeah. And these kids you're going to see come out of the womb stamped kind of a certain way. You know, you talk about the nature versus nurture argument. These kids are certainly have leanings, okay? So she gives birth to both of these two young babies, obviously here, to these young men that they're going to grow into be. 27, let's see kind of their plot in life.
When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents.
All right, now put that in some, like, not PC terms for me. What does that mean? Esau, where do we go? He became a skillful hunter, was a man of the field. What does that mean?
Rugged.
He's a man's
stinky.
Man. He wears flannel. He has a beard. he likes to hunt. He's a dude, right? He's a pair of grills. Every one of you would have liked him, dudes. You'd have looked at him and he walked in the room. You're like, yeah, that's SEAL Team 6 right there. He's what embodies a man. He looks like a dude, right? Okay? Jacob, on the other hand, is what?
Mama's
He's a man. He's a mama's boy. He is not what you would typically perceive as a dude, right? Not the stereotypical image of a guy.
He that guy that been in the game playing Xbox.
I didn't know he played Xbox, man. I think he was cooking for the guys that were playing Xbox. He's a man of the tents. I'm not bagging on Joseph, but just listen, okay? Jacob's cooking stew 2 verses later. He just has a kinship with his mom, okay? Esau, however, likes to hang out with dad. Who do you think dad's going to favor, by the way?
Esau,
right? Because he's a dude. I'm a dude. He likes to do dude things. And my other son doesn't, right? I have 3 girls at home, right? Three wonderful girls. And God has stamped them different out of the womb, right? I like to hang out in the garage. That's my space in the house. I like to change my oil. I like to work on my car, my bike, whatever, okay? The vast majority of my girls think that is the dumbest thing ever. They don't want to do that. They want to be inside cooking with mom or hanging out or whatever. One of my girls thinks that's the greatest thing ever. So when I crawl underneath the truck, she wants to come out with me. She wants to learn how to change oil. She wants to learn how to, you know, tune her derailleur on her bicycle. She thinks that's the greatest thing ever. It's much easier for me to connect with her on the natural level because the things that I like to do in my downtime, she likes to do in her downtime as well, right? They're just wired differently. It's not good or bad, it's just different. So if I'm not careful, I can have leanings to favor that child or spend more time with that child. That's not right, but it's just in my flesh easier to do. I have to make more intentional efforts to spend time with some of my other kids in areas that they care about, that I don't necessarily care about, but I need to care about because they care about. Does that make sense? So that's what you're seeing in this family. Look, Jacob is not interested in the things that his dad's interested in. Esau wants to learn how to hunt. He wants to learn how to shoot a bow. He wants to learn how to, you know, to field dress an animal, right? In the middle, that's the nature. So as you see, even though this promise was given early on, that God said the older is going to serve the younger, Isaac's like, I just like Esau better. And you're going to see the favoritism in the family and how this plays out. It's a train wreck. It's bad. But here we go. Okay? So, verse 27. Let's pick up there. We saw Jacob living in tents. 28. Now let's keep going.
Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob.
Okay, so again, you see the favoritism with mom and dad, a taste for game. What does that mean?
Wild animal.
Yeah, and also, like, you kind of think of a dude, like the way a guy's heart's through his stomach. That's kind of Esau, and you're going to see that in a big way, right? Esau's very fleshly. He's very driven by what he can taste, what he can see, what he can touch. He's not a spiritual guy. And at this point in the game, neither is Jacob. But he is very much driven by his flesh, okay? 29.
Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom.
Alright, so he's come in from hunting or whatever all day with dad. He's hungry. He says, "Let me have some of what you're cooking, Jacob." And Jacob says to him, 31.
Jacob said, sell me your birthright now.
What does that mean? Sell me your birthright. What is a birthright?
Like an inheritance?
Yeah. Let's switch spots in the family. I want all of the blessings that come with being the firstborn child. Okay, which meant just what we saw this last chapter. The promises of God, the double portion of the blessing. I want to be the first in the family. Okay, seems odd that you could sell that, but you could. You could disqualify yourself, as we're going to see guys coming from Jacob's sons that do the exact same thing because of dumb decisions that they make. One of them gets passed over because of sin. But this is something that you could apparently do. So Esau says in verse 32.
Esau said, I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me? Jacob said, swear to me now. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob.
So he sells his birthright for dinner. And not even good dinner. This is like lentil stew. Verse 34. Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank and rose and went his way. Esau despised his birthright. Like, man, come on, dude. You're not starving. You had lunch. It's just now dinner time. You're hungry. You're not famished, but you can see how driven this guy is by his flesh. When he has the opportunity to eat, he wants to eat now. He says, Jacob says, sell your birthright to him. And he says, okay, game on. Have my birthright. What do I need my birthright for? Sells it to his younger brother, and now Jacob has the rights of the firstborn. The problem is, what did God already say early on about these two kids?
Older would serve the younger.
Now, Jacob's kind of working it in his angle, which isn't right. You wonder if these two kids knew about that, knew what God said about their lives. You wonder if in the family, do you think it looked that way? Does it look like Isaac favored Jacob? Like he said, you're the one that's going to get the birthright. It doesn't feel that way. Jacob's with mom. Isaac is hanging out with his favorite son, Esau. And you're seeing now the ramifications of that and the tension between these two brothers. So it's interesting. So,
when I was reading this earlier, it was interesting in the term in the text that he used as his birthright, as if it was a joke.
Yeah.
Like, why? Like, what good is it? Or was he being sarcastic in that, dude, just feed me, I'm going to die.
Exactly.
Like,
I think that's
like,
it.
Was
I'm
it,
about to die anyway. What use is a birthright if I'm going to die? So,
right.
Apparently he thought he was really hungry. So, maybe he was. Maybe he's extraordinarily hungry. I don't know. But it seems odd that he would dump his birthright over food.
Yeah.
So
now, I was going to say, it seems like, couldn't God, like, still know that, like, hey, this guy was careless of his birthrights? And so it seems like God still used that towards to complete kind of his will for Jacob.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't, like, right what they were doing.
Right. Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. God uses sinful means all the time to accomplish his will, right? So that happens. That's not God's heart. But God already called a shot. I mean, this is 20, 30 years ago, like, prior to this story. God already said what was going to happen.
At that time.
What's that?
How old were they at this time?
They're probably late teens, I would guess. Maybe early 20s. I'd have to look at my chart and find out. I've got it somewhere, but I can't remember particularly how old they are. But still living at home, unmarried at this point. So, yeah.
Do you get the vibe that they knew or not really?
I think they knew. I think that would have been known.
Because he's like, gives it up because he's like, doesn't really
know
anything anyway.
Yeah. Possibly like, and I think in 26, the whole story is like this, not 26, 27, we're going to see it, but it's just a bizarre deal of the whole family of God trying to deceive one another to get the birthright. So I think they knew where it was supposed to go, but yet none of them have faith. None of them walk with God. Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, Esau, none of them. It's a disaster, and yet God's will is accomplished through that anyway. So I think it would have been known at very least to, obviously to mom and dad, I think the sons would have known as well. So for what it's worth. Okay. Now, 26, this is really the only chapter we get on Isaac in terms of his story. So I just want you to see the things that continue now from Abraham to his son. Alex, pick up there in 26:1.
Now, there was famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham.
Okay, why sometimes does God bring famine? Why did he bring it in Abraham's day? to test, right? So what are you seeing in Isaac's life that was the same in Abraham's? Testing. He's pushing him. He's working him. He's making his life difficult. This isn't rose-petal pass. Isaac, how are you going to respond to that? Now, this is fascinating. This is my take on why I see Abraham's specific move south to Egypt during his day of famine as sin, okay? This is what God says now to Isaac. Keep rolling, Alex.
So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in the land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and will give you the descendants of all these lands. And by your descendants in all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar.
All right. So what does that sound like to you guys? Those verses that God just says now to Isaac.
Here's what God said to Abraham.
Absolutely. It's Abrahamic covenant. Land, seed, and blessing. I gave these to your father. I'm now giving them to you. And just because he's dead does not mean these promises don't continue, right? They're continued on to you. So don't go down to Egypt. Stay here. I will provide for you. Now, before Isaac has the opportunity to pray, which he probably wasn't going to do anyway, God says to him, man, stay. I will take care of you. And I think that's a bit of a statement on Abraham of, hey, your dad boogied, and he went down to Egypt to provide for himself. I wanted him to stay. I'm inferring a little bit, but I think that was God's obviously heart to say, look, if Abraham would have stayed, I would have taken care of him. He didn't need to go to Egypt. So he stays in Gerar, okay? And he goes to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. Same guy, same title rather. This is almost 100 years later after Abraham hung out with that dude named Abimelech, which is like Pharaoh or president. It's a title. This is probably a different Abimelech, okay? Another king in that area, okay? Now, watch what else continues in our boy Isaac.
When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebecca, for she is beautiful.
Stupid.
Where do you learn that?
Dad.
You remember we read in the text, like we only saw it twice, but the text said this was as was Abraham's habit or something along those lines. Abraham did this all the time. When you watch your dad and you're learning from him, you say, well, that's how my dad does it. That got him out of a lot of hot water. I'm just going to tell a little white lie. That's fascinating to me that these patterns are passed on to our kids. Now, I don't believe in the idea of generational sin, that God's going to punish, you know, my daughters for my stupidity, which there's plenty of to punish, but I think that's going to come on me. But I do firmly believe that, man, the things that I do, the things that I say, my behaviors, my choices, they're going to affect my kids. And if I teach them sin and say, man, this is how I live my life, they're going to see those things, and they're going to learn those things, and they're going to repeat those things, just like many of you guys can attest in your own lives. It is so disheartening when you see sin in your own children. You go, that's for me, right? We would say early on, I would always say like dadgummit, you know, when I was like really mad, like that was my good strong PG-13 word, right? Dadgummit or whatever. And Madison was in the bathtub one time, I'll never forget this, and she was like 18 months old, and she took her hand and she did something and she smacked the water. She said, "Badgummit!" And I was like, oh, wow, that sounds a lot different coming out of my 2-year-old now than it does out of mine. Like, you know, and she even asked one day, she couldn't say dadgummit, she said badgummit. She's like, "Daddy, why say badgummit?" You know, just, it's funny when you see those things. And a 2-year-old, like, okay, I still have time to course correct here. But it's not funny when you see this in a 40-year-old guy that's picked up the habits of his father, and you're like, oh, man, like, you learn that from dad, right? And you're going to see that. He is his father's son, like dad, like father, like son, right? She is my sister. I don't want to die. I mean, it's the exact same story, right? Just insert new names. Verse 8, it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked through the window, and he saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. Caressing means, okay, and Abimelech said, oh boy, that is not your sister. Brothers and sisters, do not do what you are doing with your sister. So he said, man, you're a dirty liar. How then do you say she is my sister, in verse 9? And Isaac said to him, because I said I might die on her account. Man, I was cover my backside, just like my dad taught me to do, just like he did. So he gets rebuked again by the pagan, just like his daddy did. Abimelech said, what have you done to us? One of the people might have easily lain with your wife, that you would have brought guilt upon us. Man, that would have affected our relationship, my people. This is not okay. Verse 11, Abimelech charged his people, saying, whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Don't touch her.
So, in NSB it says caress.
Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah.
ESV says laughing with.
Yeah.
I'm like, I mean, depends on how hard you're laughing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine says caressing. I don't know what the Hebrew is. There must be some discrepancy in maybe how that word's used, or some dual purpose, if you will. But yeah, based on context,
well,
I think caressing is correct.
Is this the same king that took Sarah?
Same title, but probably different dude. So this is probably his successor or son or, yeah.
So it's been, he's following his dad, just like
Jake. And this guy, what do you notice about Abimelech here? Abimelech number two. He's got integrity. He's calling the non-Christian to, or the Christian to a standard as a non-Christian. Let's live rightly with one another. Every time you see Abimelech, you like him. Like, it's like, man, this guy has the integrity that I think Abraham was supposed to have and Isaac was supposed to have. And this non-Christian is the one that's exemplifying integrity at this point, not the family of God, right? And it's going to get worse in 27 before it gets better. So anyway, fascinating. Again, just the sins of the father handed down to the son. So now, verse 12, as is continued in the Old Testament, Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in that year a hundredfold. That is a ton of blessing, right? Verse 13, he became very rich. He continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so the Philistines envied him. So what else continues in Isaac's life?
Keeps getting blessed.
Yeah, is God blessing this guy? Yeah. In spite of himself, God is still blessing Isaac. So he has a ton of stuff, which, again, prosperity in the Old Testament was a sign of God's blessing upon you, so he's blessed, okay? Now, 15, this is kind of cool. These are some of the, maybe the spiritual insights into Isaac's life that you go, okay, man, he's not all totally jacked up. 15.
So the Philistines. All the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines, stopped up by filling them with earth.
That's, by the way, that's dirty, right? You dig a well, and then someone fills it back up with dirt. You're like, you have any idea how long it takes, how difficult that is? I mean, that's not cool, okay? And instead of just taking them, they're like, you know what? The heck with you. We're going to fill them back up with dirt to get you out of here is the idea. So they're jealous, they're envious, they fill them up with dirt. Keep rolling.
Then Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are too powerful for us.
Yeah, speaking of passive aggressive, right? Like, oh, you have no water anymore. Maybe you should go somewhere else. Like, he doesn't have a conversation. Just leave. So Isaac leaves. Verse 17, goes through the valley of Gerar and settles there. Keep rolling on 18, Katie.
Then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham, and he gave them the same names which his father had given them.
All right, pause there for a second. There's some cool spiritual insight to this other than just maybe the practical. So what does he leaves the land, and what does Isaac do in terms of finding water?
He redigs the wells of his father.
Yeah, why would you do that?
He knows there's water there.
Yeah, you know there's water there. Okay, so it's smart. Okay, so dig where you know there's water. That's good planning, okay? And he gives them the same names which his father had given them. So he redigs those wells, and he calls them what his dad called them. On a spiritual, in a spiritual sense, read into that for me a little bit. Why is that important?
Well, his father was at a certain point in his life where those wells that were dug were to reclaim the dirt or reclaim the land. And then he gave honor to God.
Yeah.
And so it's the same sense. He knew that this was the trail and the track that his father had taken. So he's in the same spot, and he's like, there's no sense in reclaiming over what my father had done. I will reclaim them and give honor to God as my father did.
Yeah. There's times in life where we don't need his new truth. We need to uncover the old truth, right? In a generation and a world that's fascinated with the newest and greatest and latest, especially in the Christian world, we don't need that. We need to recover the gospel. We need to talk about the things of our Bible. We need to elevate the things that have been around for a long time. Now, we need to be creative in the way we do that, in our methodology and such, but man, our message doesn't need to change. So I think there's kind of just a piece of that, that, and a guide to this, I forget who it was, a sermon on that, and just talked about that idea. Man, redig old wells. Uncover that dirt of our forefathers. There's a lot to there, okay? So, Problem was, Isaac's servants dug the well in the valley, found water, and as soon as they found water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, "That water's ours." Like, wait a second. Those are my dad's wells. You stopped them up. I redug them. I found water, and now you're saying that's our water. So they named the well Essek because they contended with him. That's what Essek means. 21, they dug another well. They quarreled with that one too, called it Sitna, which is enmity. So like basically he names the two wells like strife and quarreling, so not good. He moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he named it Rehoboth, which means plenty of room. How do you notice Isaac interacting with the non-Christian, with the people of the land? What does he do?
Arguing?
Yeah, a bit, but to a point, and then what does he do? He's like, okay, that's your water? Okay, I'll flex, I'll go somewhere else. I'll dig another well, which is costing, so on and so forth. It's a big deal. I was talking to a farmer friend of mine the other day. Wells today, like in farming, if you've got to dig, I don't know, like he said, 1,500 feet on some of his property, after you add up all the pumping and all the other things you have to do, $750,000 to dig a well. $300 a foot to dig a well. Gosh.
Cool.
That's farmers, right? So you think about the risk that some of those guys take. Probably wasn't that difficult in terms of depth at this point, obviously, but nonetheless, wells are a big deal. Okay, so he flexes with a non-Christian, which is good. You saw that in his dad, right? His dad had built a reputation amongst the non-Christians in the land. He worked with them. He flexed with them. He went to battle with them. And Isaac's able to flex when he needs to. And God shows up and gives him room in the land. Okay, verse 22, "At last the Lord has made room for us. We shall be fruitful in the land." And he went up from there to Beersheba. Okay, again, the home location of the patriarchs. 24, watch what God does.
"And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, 'I am the God of Abraham. Fear not, for I am with you, and I will bless you and multiply your offspring with Abraham's sake.' So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well."
All right, again, you see, again, God's promise repeated to him. This is now the second time. You're seeing a bit of maturity out of this guy. This is the first time we've seen him build an altar. So maybe some of Daddy's good qualities are also getting passed down the line. So encouraging to see these two and their relationship. Isaac is progressing in his walk with God. Okay, 26, more on Isaac and Abimelech. Pick up there.
"When Abimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahuza, his advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his army, Isaac said to them, 'Why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and sent me away from you?'"
So these are the same guys that a couple chapters ago, last chapter, gave him the boot and took all his wells. He's like, "Why are you guys back? Are you coming to take more of my wells?" And they said, no, it's on our heart. 28, keep rolling.
"They said, 'You see plainly that the Lord has been with you.' So we said, 'Let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us, and let us make covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done you nothing but good and sent you away in peace.'"
This is cool. So these guys make a covenant with Isaac. Say, "Man, let's live in peace. Let's not continue this tense relationship. Let's change that." Same with Abraham and Abimelech before, right? They decide to live rightly together, to be honest with one another. We saw that in chapter 21. It's a good thing, okay? They made them a feast. They ate and they drank. In the morning they arose early, exchanged their oaths, and they departed from there in peace. So Isaac lives in the land with non-Christians, in prosperity, but in peace with those that are around him. They know who he stands for. They don't worship his God, but he's able to live in a right way amongst non-Christians. Okay, 32, he continues to find water. And 33, they call that place Sibna, another well. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. You can literally go to Beersheba and see a replica today of this well. Abraham dug one in that area. Jacob dug one. Isaac digs one, but there's a well right outside the city today that's literally go down and look in it in Beersheba. So cool to see something that's 4,000 years old. Where would they have drawn water from? Okay. 34 now, the story turns to our boy Esau. Read that.
"When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basmah."
And is the key word in that sentence. Wife number two, Basemath. Yeah, that's a weird name.
Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite.
Who are the Hittites? We've seen them before. So Abraham bought the property from, right? The Hittites. They live in the land, but they're not followers of the Lord. So what does Esau do? There's two problems with this.
He marries two women that are not believers.
He marries two women who are both not believers. And by the way, he's going to pick up a third later on, next chapter. Okay. What does that tell you about his birthright, the things of God, following the lineage of his grandfather Abraham? He don't care at all. Okay, you get an idea that this thing's like, what is my birthright to me? I don't care. I don't want to live that life. I'm going to do what I want.
It says in the latter part of 35, it says Esau's wives made life miserable for Isaac and Rebekah, meaning that they were all living together? They were all traveling together?
No, they're gonna be separate. What does that mean then?
Mine says they brought grief. I think Isaac was saddened by it.
He's heartbroken.
Oh, okay.
This is his favorite son. And what's he choosing? Two wives, two non-Christian wives. This is a big middle finger to his dad and a big middle finger to the family of God and everything it stands for. I don't want anything to do with it. It's like, man, this is just a hard kid and he doesn't want to repent, right? Part of his birthright. He's just telling me the thing, spiritual things don't matter to me. They don't matter. And to Isaac, he's like, oh, it kills me, right? I love you. I love you more than Jacob, but you don't care, okay? So that's the idea. Now, 27 is a divine comedy. It is a disaster. Everybody in the chapter is in sin. Rebecca, Isaac, Jacob, and Esau, we're going to see all four of their stories. This is like a four-part play. There's four scenes that are going to unfold. And at the epicenter of all of this is this idea of the birthright, okay? God has already stated the older will serve the younger. Esau has already sold his birthright, in case it wasn't clear from the get-go. Jacob already has that. Nobody cares. They're going to get what they want regardless of what God says, every one of them. And at the end of chapter 27, what God wants to get done is going to get done, but it's going to get done in a way that God would prefer not to do it, okay? And unfortunately, we do that all the time to God, right? He's going to accomplish his will, regardless, but sometimes through means that aren't his favorite. So, case in point, chapter 27. This is a wheels-off nightmare. Okay, 27:1.
When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am."
All right, so again, you see this idea with the eyes frequently. With dim eyes means spiritually dim sometimes, as well as eyes were kind of the window to your soul. So when your eyes are dim and you're about to die, right? Maybe cataracts is kind of how we think physically about that today, but eyes are dim. Okay, so he's calling his oldest son to him. Keep going.
He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me a delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die."
All right, so what is Isaac saying to his favorite son Esau?
He's going to give him a blessing.
I'm going to give you the blessing. First, I need what? Food, because I'm a fleshly guy. I want a big fat steak and some potatoes and some asparagus and a glass of wine, and then maybe I will bless you. So he wants his food first. So where did Esau learn these things, right? He's just like his dad. He's fleshly. And I'm going to bless you. This isn't like, hey, I'm going to give you the second blessing, because God said to bless your brother Jacob first. That's not what he's saying. Go get my food, keep it on the DL. I'm going to eat, and then I'm going to give you the blessing of the firstborn child. That's his intent, and that's Esau's intent. So Esau says, great, game on. Okay, scene 2, verse 5.
Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord, before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me two good young goats so that I may prepare them delicious food for your father, such as he loves."
All right, so you're seeing again this back and forth. Do you see the favoritism in this family? I mean, it's so clear. Rebecca hears this conversation and says, oh no, my favorite son isn't going to get the blessing. Jacob, here's what we're going to do. Go get me a goat. I'm going to prepare a meal. You're going to bring this to dad. And you're going to get the blessing instead, in verse 11. Instead of Esau, you'll get it. And Jacob says, I mean, logically, hey, behold, my brother Esau is hairier than I am. I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall be as a deceiver, literally a Jacob in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. Dad's going to feel me. He's going to recognize I'm not hairy, I'm smooth, unlike my brother. There's no way he's going to give me the blessing. And his mom says to him, the curse will be on me, my son. Obey my voice. Go do what I asked you to do. He brings now the food, verse 14, to his mom. 15, Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son. So she's going to take now Esau's clothes and put Jacob in them, which are in her house, and put them on her son Jacob. 16, she put the skins of young goats on his hands and on the very smooth part of his neck. How hairy is Esau when you're putting goat skin on your arms and neck? Son, I mean, this guy's a hairy dude. So there you go, man. So have you ever heard the story of Shay's brother? Epic, 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 epic. Shay's older brother proves Darwinism. Okay, I mean, he just does. He's walking on the beach. Actually, I didn't tell you the story. He's walking on the beach one day, and someone came up to him and asked him why he had on a sweater. His shirt off. Are you kidding me? Yeah. So, yeah. Godly guy, wonderful dude. They should have named him Esau. So, yeah. I lived with Shay for a long time. He got some of his brother's genes. So, anyway, this is what I think of. I think of David Sumlin every time I think of this guy. So, he is hairy, right? So, they're moving forward with this. She gave him, don't tell these stories because Shay's got better stuff on me than I got on him, unfortunately. So, all right. So, this is the plan, okay? Isaac and Esau. Esau, I'm going to bless you. Okay. Rebecca hears all this and says, No. We're going to thwart this. Okay. We're going to sin. I mean, it's a comedy of errors of what they're doing. Okay. Now, 18, scene number 3. Somebody pick up there.
So he went to the father and said, my father. And he said, here I am. Who are you, my son?
Okay. Now, this is Jacob speaking with his dad, Isaac. Okay.
Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me.
All right, he's deceiving his old father who cannot see anymore. I'm going to get the blessing. So he's lying, Rebekah's lying, Isaac's lying, Esau's lying. Everybody's lying. 20.
But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? He answered, because the Lord your God granted me success.
Oh man. Because God is in this, Dad. God is blessing me. It's like Isaac has enough spiritual insight to go, something's off. Something's not right. How is it that this has happened? And now Jacob lies to him and says, God is in this, right? Like, oh, buddy.
He says the Lord your God. Is that intentional or is that just...
To some degree, I think so. Jacob does not have a walk with God like he's going to have a walk with God in 40 years, 20 years. So I think so. I think it's a good observation, Jimmy. There's certainly some maturing that's going to happen in him. And what his relationship looks like to the Lord, I don't know. He's fine with lying, but so is everybody else. Okay. I want you to notice some characteristics of Isaac in here. Right? He has a check in his spirit. Something is awry with this situation. Okay. Kyle, keep rolling.
Then Isaac said to Jacob, please come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not.
So how is he going to determine the truth here?
By touch.
By what he can touch, by what he can feel, what he can smell, what he can see or can't see. What do you call those things? Is it spiritual?
No.
It's flesh. It's all flesh. Isaac is driven by his flesh. And he relies on not faith. Nobody in this chapter has a lick of faith. Nobody trusts that what God said before these two kids came out the womb would happen if they didn't deceive and trick and manipulate and, you know, all of that. Nobody has that. Isaac especially. He's a leader of the family. But everything he does is by his flesh and his senses that he can trust in. So, keep going in 22.
So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him and said, are you really my son Esau?
So you can get this idea, like you see him like doubting. I hear Jacob, but I feel Esau. I smell Esau. And it's Esau, right? Just it's a sad picture of there's no prayer, there's no check, there's no it's awful. Keep rolling.
He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered him, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate, and brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the hands of his garments, and he blessed him and said...
All right, so that's it. That was with the straw that broke the camel's back for him. It smells like Esau. This is Esau. Touch Esau, I smell Esau, I hear Jacob, but this is Esau. And the words are saying one thing, but I hear another. Now, listen to this. This is the blessing that Isaac intended to give to Esau, that he's mistakenly giving to Isaac. Jacob. Gosh, too many names. Listen to this. "See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Now may God give you the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, the abundance of new wine and grain. May people serve you, nations bow down to you, be masters of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you." This is the exact opposite of what God said would happen with his sons. Can you imagine that level of defiance at the end of your life to say, "I'm not going to bless this son. This is my favorite." Like, these kids are going to live now in an aftermath of the favoritism that was displayed in their home, clearly. And you're going to see it now in the way Jacob raises his sons. Jacob's biggest struggle as a father will be favoritism to his favorite son, and it causes a disaster in his son's life. Kyle, do you have a thought? Or a...
I was just agreeing.
Thomas?
In a way, the blessing that he gives to Jacob, thinking that it's Esau, can still apply to Jacob. The fact that he says, like, may your mother's sons, may you rule over them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's intending that for Isaac, but he fulfills what God spoke.
He absolutely does. And I want you guys to read this like a will. That sign, it's done, it's put away, it's put in an envelope, is unchangeable. When a father gives this deathbed blessing speech, this is it. There is no, wait, let me add this. Or, let me take that back. It's done. So I don't know how that worked in that society, but this is legal, courtroom, signed, sealed, delivered. There is no changing what you've said. Masters of your brothers, may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. Land, seed, blessing. He is handing the Abrahamic covenant, now that it was on Isaac, to his son Esau. But it's Jacob. So, and by the way, all of this will be fulfilled. This is the promise that God wanted to go to Jacob, and it does. He just had to use a different means to get there because all of his children are in sin, all four of them. Okay. Now, scene four. Esau has been hunting the whole time, and now he comes back in, prepares his savory dish. He comes in from hunting in verse 30. 31, he brought his dish to his father and said, "Hey, it's my turn for the blessing. Like, Dad, I did just what you said." 32, Isaac said to his father, "Who are you?" And he's thinking, "Oh, doo-doo. I am your son, your firstborn, Esau." Like, what do you mean, who am I? You just sent me out to go get you food. I caught it, I killed it, I cooked it, and now I'm bringing it to you, just like you asked. 33, pick up there.
Then Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me? So I ate of it all before you came and blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed."
Like, it's done. Isaac realizes, I can't undo what I just said. I bust the wrong kid, and now he's in panic. By the way, what are you learning about Jacob just in the midst of this? Like, just to highlight a moment in his life. How does he survive? What's his MO in life?
He's crafty.
Tricky, deception, crafty. He's a smart guy. He's going to spend the next 20 years of his life with a guy by the name of Laban. And he's the one guy on the face of the earth that is more tricky and crafty than he is. He's going to get worked by Uncle Laban. Worked. Literally. And the beauty of it is, God has to work this out of him. Because this isn't trust. This isn't faith. This isn't, this is fleshly, and I can, God, you're good up to this point. But man, in the 8, 9s, and 10s of my life, when my birthright is on the line, faith doesn't matter. What matters is I've got to get it done. And that's what Jacob is used to. And God's going to say, oh no, that's not going to work in your life. So this is what he's learning to do. And is he smarter than his blind old dad? Yeah. Okay. Is Rebecca helping? Yeah. So, I mean, this is his MO in life. So panic ensues with Isaac. He realizes, man, I cannot change this. 34, Isaac heard, I'm sorry, Esau heard the words of his father. He cried out exceedingly great and bitter. And said, bless me even now, my father. And he said, your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. Who does Isaac blame in verse 34?
Jacob.
Or 35. Jacob. Whose fault is this?
Isaac.
It's Isaac's. I'm in disobedience. I chose not to obey God. But he passes the buck again. It's just, it's bad. And ultimately, all this is from God. So it's a rough deal, okay? Yeah,
Jacob there?
They're still there in the vicinity. Yeah, and he's about to hightail it out. Man, this is these are his last moments at home for sure. But yeah, they're still around. Okay, Esau says, "Is it not rightly named Jacob? Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he supplanted me these two times. He's tricked me. He took away my birthright, and now he's taking away my blessing." Well, that's what the birthright was the blessing. Isaac, I think, or Esau rather, doesn't even understand the magnitude of what he did when he sold his birthright. He just, in a moment's decision, and now he's seeing the ramifications of that. Behold, verse 37, Isaac says to Esau, I've made him your master, and your relatives I have given to him as servants with grain and wine. I've sustained him, and I'm hosed. So 39, Esau, here's your blessing. Here's what I meant to give to your younger brother, Jacob. Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, away from the dew in the heaven above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall come when you become restless that you shall break the yoke from your neck. That doesn't sound very positive, because it's not. You're going to live in futility, away from the blessing, away from the dew, a servant to your brother, and then one day you're going to bow up and you're going to break from underneath the yoke of your brother. But it's not positive. It's not good. It's a rough end to this chapter. Okay, 41. Watch how Esau now responds to that. Leah, pick up there.
Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.
Whoa. So we're going to let dad die, and then after we're done mourning and the funeral's over, what's next on my list?
Kill my brother.
I'm going to kill you. And he ain't screwing around.
I will.
Now, if you're Jacob, mama's boy with an apron on and cooking in the kitchen, and you're looking at your bowed up, you know, bench pressing brother, with, you're thinking, this is not even a match. Like, I'm going to die. There is no contest here. I'm screwed. And he realizes that. And Esau hates his brother. This is not a small grudge. This is a big deal. So when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she called in verse 42 her younger son Jacob and said to him, behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you. The only thing that's going to make him feel better is your head on a platter. He's going to kill you. Now therefore, my son, 43, read that.
Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother, in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away.
So what's her plan?
Run.
Yeah, run. Get your knapsack, pack up your stuff, get out of here. Esau will calm down. Stay there how long?
A few days.
A few days. Anybody know how long Jacob spends with Laban?
14 years.
20
About 20 years.
This is the last time he sees his mother alive. She dies before he's able to come back. And he stays there because of fear of Esau for 20 years. That fury, at least to Jacob, never subsides. He's never aware that his brother has changed his course. So this is the rest of this young man's life, and God is doing exactly what he wants to do with Jacob, which is getting him out from underneath his family, alone, and he's going to work him over. Okay.
So Esau gets over it eventually.
We'll see. So she says in verse 45, stay until your brother's anger chills out. I will send you and get you from there. So once he's cool, I'll call for you. Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day? Meaning, my husband's going to die, and then you're going to die the same day. So, or closely there within. So she says, man, get out of town. So I'm going to send you back to my brother, Laban, your uncle, and you're going to go stay with him. Okay. Rebecca said to Isaac, listen to this lie. I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like Esau did, the Hittites, from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? So this is the pitch that she gives to Isaac. Hey, I want to send our son back home to where the godly women are, just like Abraham did, to go get a wife. Ha, me. So let's send him back. So that's the story. And Isaac goes, okay, that makes sense. So Jacob is now going to roll out of town, and he's going to leave. Okay. 28 verse 1. Let's watch this play.
So Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him. Then he commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Paddan Aram, to the house of your mother's father, Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother.
Okay, so he says, he's in with the story, and this makes sense. Don't get a pagan wife, go up north. Okay, so Paddan Aram is Haran, so where Abraham's family relocated out of Ur, and they set up shop and kind of paused there before they came into the promised land. That's where Jacob is going. That's where now Abraham's lineage is. Isaac's family is there. And he says, may God Almighty bless you. Verse 3, make you fruitful, multiply, may you become companies of people, may you be blessed, may he give you the blessing of Abraham. So Isaac's kind of realizing, man, I've done what I've done, so may God give you the blessing that I gave you, mistakenly, but nonetheless, may you be blessed. Okay, Isaac sent Jacob away in verse 5, went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the brother of Rebekah. So he's now hanging out with Uncle Laban. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob, sent him away to Paddan Aram, so he takes now a second wife. As a result of this, you'll see in verse 9, Esau went to Ishmael, okay, the Ishmaelites that we talked about earlier, and married, besides the wives he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael. So Esau marries Ishmael's daughter as another way just to give the middle finger to his dad. Like, I am ticked. I've got two pagan women from the Hittites. I'm going to go pick up a third from the line from your dad, by the way, that is not blessed. I'm going to go get a daughter from Ishmael. I'm going to marry Ishmael's very daughter. So three women, and he's just, Esau is a bitter, angry, flesh-driven man, just like his dad Isaac. And he is stewing for 20 years on, when am I going to get a chance to kill my brother Jacob? And that's what the next 20 years of Jacob's life are going to be about, as well as Esau's. Okay? Now, verse 10. This is cool. Read this.
Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran.
All right, so very, very south of the land, Beersheba. He's going north to Haran. Keep rolling.
He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place.
All right, now talk to me about this for a second. This is Jacob. Has Jacob been in a house before? Much less camping in the wilderness? This is Esau territory, right? Outside, outdoors. No food, hunt game, whatever you need to do. This is very comfortable for Esau. This is not comfortable for Jacob. So God gets him out of home. He's been, based on where he's at, this is a multiple day journey to get where he's at in this process. He is alone, which is the first time in the story that we've seen him alone. He's out in the middle of nowhere. He's outside of his comfort zone. He's in a difficult spot, and he has now a dream in verse 12.
Behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants.
So who shows up here? God. Why? What's this picture here? A ladder from heaven to earth and angels going up and down this ladder. What's the picture? Jacob's in the middle of the desert, or middle of the wilderness at least at this point, somewhere in the middle of nowhere. with a rock as a pillow, and the possessions that he left with that he could carry. Maybe he's got a donkey or something, but what's the picture here? What's God saying?
Is it, you talking about the angel?
Yeah. What's
going up from the ladder?
Yeah, what's going on here?
I don't know. It's kind of like that saying, praises go up, blessings come down. So angels kind of going back and forth to bless him from the heavens.
Certainly a blessing in this. What else?
I think it's a big presentation that, you know, you have like the Holy of Holies coming and showing that this land belongs to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, in your uncomfort, in your frustration, in where you're at, even the lowest of lowlies that you are at, this is what I'm going to provide and give you, that you're not forgotten. I mean, if I went out in the middle of the desert and I was just there and this wasn't my, because, you know, I'm not a hunter, but I was out there, I would feel literally alone.
Totally.
Like, who else do I have to, and then
totally.
All of a sudden God shows up and he's like,
yep.
I'm here.
Yep.
Like, it's kind of a check in the back of your mind. It's like, wow, mm-hmm. I was literally in the middle of nowhere and you showed up.
Yeah, listen to what Jacob says in verse 16. Surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it.
Right.
Like, God knows where I'm at in the middle of nowhere. And what does he give Jacob? Verse 15, behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised to you. What was all of last chapter for Jacob?
All on his own.
Sin. And what's this? God's saying, I'm with you. I didn't abandon you. You're an idiot. However, I love you, and I'm not done with you. I'm not finished with you just because you're an idiot.
This is the same thing that he says and that God says later on in Joshua 1:9.
Yeah.
He says it at the end of Matthew during the Great Commission.
Yeah. 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 He's going to send him. He's going to be with him, right? It's a cool picture of God showing up in the most unlikely of places. So it's a neat picture. So this is going to be such a big deal. Yeah, Jimmy, sorry, you want to say something earlier?
I also like the fact that there's a stairway with angels going up and down, and that it's not just, you know, one or two angels that are kind of just sitting around watching. It's like the whole entire...
It's continuing.
Heaven go around as well.
It's like God pulled back the veil real quick of the physical so he can see the spiritual and what's happening around him. Yeah, there's angels descending and ascending, and it's a show, right? Led Zeppelin wrote a song about it. So cool. So those of you that don't know who Led Zeppelin is, that's a band. By the way,
it's a
Zeppelin. So cool deal. Now, verse 17. Watch his response.
And he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven."
So he names that place House of God, Bethel. Okay, verse 18. 19 rather, he called that place Bethel. Okay, Bet means house. El, whenever you see that in a Hebrew word, means God. Okay, so Bethlehem means what? House of bread. So anytime as you guys are seeing these words, they're significant. Okay, Bet is house. Read that through the scripture. El is God. So he means this place called Bethel. It's also named in verse 19, Luz. Okay, we prefer Bethel. But this is going to be like one of those... this is an altar for Jacob. This is a memory. This is a big deal, this place, because God ministered to him. This is not something that you easily forget. This is a once-in-a-lifetime type experience. So as you think about Jacob's journey, this is a landmark event, and his life is beginning to shift a little bit. He understands God's with him. He is indeed the recipient of the blessing, and God's not going to desert him. Okay. Watch now his response to this. Verse 20.
Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all of that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you."
Make some observations for me. What does Jacob say in response?
He's going to tithe.
Yeah, he's going to tithe the gods he sees at the end. He's going to give him a tenth of his stuff, okay?
He's giving God a condition.
Yeah. It feels very conditional, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If God does such and such, then I will do this. There's some debate as to whether or not this means if or since. Since God has done these things, then I will do these things. So one of the more, at least one of my trusted commentators, he takes that view, the latter, and says, man, this is not conditional. He is saying, because of this moment in time, because God has shown up, I will no doubt return to this place. God will no doubt bless me. And as a result of my faith, I'm going to give God, just like Abraham did, a tenth of my possessions. I'm going to voluntarily tithe as a affirmation of his words to me. So regardless, you're going to see Jacob do a whole lot of growing up. So this could be conditional. I don't know. I kind of lean towards that side, actually. The guys smarter than me don't. So take that for what it's worth. You're going to see Jacob mature over time. And you're going to see some of this if-then bargaining with God kind of get worked out of him over time. So there is no doubt a covenant. There's a promise. There is some realization that Jacob isn't God, right? There's a bigger guy than me out there that's watching over me, and he's committed to be with me. He's going to bless me, but boy, it's going to be a long time coming. And we got to work some Jacob out of Jacob before God's going to use him.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in that regard, with his character and the way that he uses things to his advantage and the trickster style that he is, it kind of sounds, even if we use sense, it kind of sounds like he's going to use all of the things that God is promising to him for his purpose.
Yeah.
And like, since that is the case, then I'm going to use this God centeredness to accomplish whatever is in his heart at this time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, there's still a lot of trickster left in Jacob. So we're going to see that get worked out. So yeah, I don't see it as like this gigantic life-changing moment in his life where everything's great after this. It's certainly not. So now, 29:1, let's continue on the journey. Stephanie, pick up there.
And Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. And as he looked, he saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For out of that well, the flocks full of water.
All right, so he rolls up north, right? He's in Padan Aram, in Haran, and he goes to now meet his family. So, sorry, keep rolling.
The stone on the mouth was large. And when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, my brothers, where do you come from? They said, we are from Haran. He said to them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? They said, we know him.
All right, so I'm showing up to this random well. There's guys watering the sheep. Great. I'm supposed to meet some guy named Laban, the son of Nahor. Y'all know him? Yeah, we do. I'm like, holy cow. Thank you, Lord. Okay. Verse 6. Is it well with him? And they said, it is well. And here's his daughter Rachel, his daughter, coming now with the sheep. Okay, verse 7. Keep going.
He said, behold, it is still high day. Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go, pasture them. But they said, we cannot until all the flocks are gathered together, and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep.
Okay, so this is an interesting deal. So he meets these random guys. He says, hey, do you know this dude? Oh, yeah, we know Nahor. In fact, here's his daughter, Rachel, rolling up right now. And what does he say to the shepherds when he sees this girl rolling up?
Leave.
Leave. Hurry up and water your sheep. Go away. Why would he say that?
She's nice.
Yeah, she's pretty. And I don't want any competition. So all y'all go away. And they said, we can't until all of our flocks are, you know, watered. And here comes now Rachel. Verse 9. Kyle, pick up there. Speaking of nice.
Okay. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess.
Okay, again, this is fascinating. When you guys think shepherd in the Old Testament, what imagery comes to mind?
Dudes with canes walking around.
Yeah. You need to think youngest female daughter, 8, 10 years old, that's women's work in this day and age. Okay? Shepherding wasn't for the dudes. Guys did other stuff. Your youngest son, if you didn't have any daughters, would maybe do that. See also David. But this was women's work. And even when you go now to Israel, I was out on one of our trips, and we were coming into this Bedouin community in Beersheba in that area, and lo and behold, there's this probably 9-year-old girl with a flock of like 40 sheep and her staff, and she is shepherding sheep. She's leading them to green pastures and walking through there. I'm like, so that's the mental image. This is what Rachel's occupation would have been.
Was she 9 or 10?
So there's an argument for
egalitarianism right there. There I'm just playing.
Sorry. Troy, wait.
Can you say something?
Yes.
Was she 9 or 10, or was she probably older?
She's older, for sure. But this wasn't a job that you had to be, like, 20 to do.
Okay.
This was given to, right? My youngest daughter, who's 10, could be shepherding our sheep at home, right? No problem. My older daughters would have been probably hanging out with mom, learning the skill sets of that and what have you. So, in that culture. So, just fascinating that this is considered, this would have been a woman's job, primarily, unless you didn't have women. It was given to the youngest son, which would have been, by the way, a bit of an insult. So, keep that in mind as we get to David in like 15 years. Okay, keep rolling. Where are we, 10?
Yeah. Now, as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud.
All right, now this is an appropriate kiss. This is my, like, I think sister in Christ kiss, and he weeps. Why would he weep? I don't think so this time. Good answer. It was a good answer the first time. It's wrong the second time.
He's happy he's not alone anymore. He found his family.
I'm not alone? What did God just do, right? This was a couple days ago now. But God said, man, I'm with you. I'm going to lead you where you need to go type deal. And sure enough, he walks into town and the first person he meets are a bunch of shepherds that say, there's your family. There's your future wife, by the way. One of them. So you're here, man. That's family. So he's wrecked in the idea that God has shown up. So he's amazed, right? Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of his father, that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. So she goes to Bethuel, her dad, and is going to tell now the news to her pops. So it came about, verse 13, when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him, embraced him, and kissed him, brought him to his house, and they related to Laban all these things. And Laban said, surely you are bone of my flesh, and he stayed with him a month. Come on in. You got a place to stay. Your family, we love you. You're safe. Like, this is a big deal to Jacob, right? He is not built for outside. But he's going to be. God's going to work him over. Okay? So he stays now with Laban for a month. Okay? Now, 15. Let's pick up the story with the few moments we have left.
Then Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?
All right, now, he's been there a month, and Jacob's been serving, right? He's doing, you got poop to clean up, animals need to get fed, like, what's to do around here? So he's working for Laban, for free, right? So what does Laban say?
That he would want a good pay himself.
Yeah, hey, dude, you're working for me for free. Don't be my cousin, nephew, how about you be my employee? Like, you should get paid to do what you do. Now, if you're Jacob, how does that sound? I've been working for free for a month, and now you're going to pay me to do what I was already doing.
Good.
Heck yeah, absolutely. What's Laban doing? He's changing the nature of the relationship. If you're not paid by a guy, you're free to walk whatever you want to do, right? There's no strings attached, there's no PTO to get, there's no vacation, you know, there's no expectations. Now, when you're an employee, and you have an employer, i.e. a boss, what is Laban doing with Jacob? Man, I own you. I control you. I have your paycheck. I have your interest, you know. So he's working the system. Now, how does he pitch this to Jacob? Buddy, this is totally within your benefit. You've been working for free. Don't do that. Let me pay you. So Jacob's like, oh, yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you. That's so nice of you. That's not at all what Laban's doing. Laban is Jacobing Jacob, right? Because Laban is the master. This is the sensei. This is Mr. Miyagi. He is the Karate Kid. He doesn't know how good Laban is at being Jacob. He's about to get out Jacob, if you will. Okay. So Laban says, great. What do you want your wages to be? What do you want me to pay you, Jacob? And verse 16, here's what he wants.
Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel.
All right, so we've met Rachel. We saw her at the well. She's the younger of the two daughters, i.e. the shepherdess. Leah's the older, okay? You see a description of these two in verse 17.
And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face.
Huh, so we see a description of Leah, which is what? Her eyes are weak, okay? Does that mean she's got glasses? Contextually, what does that mean? What is that contrasted with? Rachel's good vision? No.
No, her spiritual walk.
No.
Beautiful form and face.
Yes. Okay. Her eyes are weak as opposed to her sister who is beautiful in form and face. Rachel's pretty. Leah is not. Okay. I could go into detail and describe that further, but that's the idea. Now, what's the problem when you're the older sister in this culture and you're ugly and your sister's smoking hot? Who's younger? Are you going to be married first? No, that is a problem because everybody's checking out your sister, right? Like, oh, dang it. So Leah's got an issue. So she's not attractive to, at least to Jacob. And again, Jacob's pretty fleshly, so he looks at what he looks at. She's pretty. Okay. That's Jacob. So we got an issue. Okay. Let's pause there. We'll pick up there tomorrow and watch kind of how this story continues. But you can imagine now what Jacob is going to request for payment from Uncle Laban.
Hey guys, real quick.
Good times.
I just want to apologize. I was the one that wrote that, and it was passing aggressive. <I've seen that. laughs> No, but I think like I've had. You guys saw me take the milk, and so I didn't model that well for you guys. So it was my fault on that. Two, like I had a couple conversations with a couple people saying like stop drinking it. It's a staff milk. It's kind of okay if I do it because I'm staff, but. So I had a couple conversations about it, and like we kept doing it, and so that's what made me go passive aggressive, which is not what I should have done. But at the same time, I think I was trying to protect one of my leaders. It puts extra work on her plate, so I don't want that either. But I'm sorry for
it's okay, Alex.
Being
okay.
Passive aggressive.
It's all good, Alex.
You're a group hug. Are we okay?
Yeah.
You all good?
Boom.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate
I'll,
that.
I'll bring.
This says a lot.
I'll bring milk tomorrow.
It's not almond milk.
All right. See you tomorrow.
Hilarious.